Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Season 2 of Racing Lives. This is the first episode, and I'm so excited to be back. My name's Aurélie Donzelot, and in this podcast, I use motorsport as an excuse to chat to some of the most inspiring women I know. And what a lineup of ladies have I got for you this season. I am so excited, and we're starting with an amazing, amazing guest. I cannot wait for you to hear her. Each week, as ever, brings a different guest, and we discuss everything from career beginnings to what it's truly like to be involved in one of the fastest sports in the world. The essential message which I always try to convey to anyone listening with a view to one day working in motorsport is that it is incredibly rewarding. It's every bit as amazing as it looks, but it requires huge dedication, hours and hours of work, and as the cliche goes, blood, sweat and tears. I like to be prepared, so unsurprisingly, I did as much research on my guest as possible, and the more I found, the more I came to realise that she is the epitome of that very message. Her career in motorsport so far has been fantastic, thanks to her tremendous work ethic and fighting spirit. But it has also required every waking hour of every day, every ounce of energy, and it seems at times so much of her heart. I cannot wait to hear my guest's thoughts on this. I suspect she'll tell me that I'm wrong to praise her so much, though I hope she realises that she's proven this right so many times already. My guest today is the incredible Claire Williams.
I don't know what to say. Thanks.
I got tingles.
Theory. But you know, you're quite right. I hate hearing stuff like that about me because, and I do, you know, it's funny because obviously I haven't been in F1 now for a good couple of months. And when I'm on my occasional walks and, you know, I'm running or whatever, and I think back that I did that, and I'm like, my God, did I really run a Formula One team? Even just a short space, you know, afterwards. And I think, my God, did I do that? Did I go through that? You know, bloody hell. And it's really, when you step back from it and you have that time to reflect, it's fascinating how you think about it. And I think to myself, oh, my God, most of the kind of stuff I'm feeling now is embarrassment. It's like, oh, no. God, did I do that? Did people just think I was, you know, an idiot? Did I have any right to be in the role that I was in? How, you know, all that kind of stuff, you think, oh dear. So it's actually quite nice that you've just introed with that, Aurélie. I appreciate it. Giving me a bit more self-esteem back.
I mean, I just say as it is, because I've not been involved with the team at all whilst you've been running it. So I've been from a very privileged position, been able to see what you're up to. And well, that's exactly what I think. I think you gave it everything and you did really well.
Thanks. I did, you know, I gave it my all. I don't think I could have given it any more. But towards the end, you know, and when it was really difficult, and, you know, last year and even the kind of 2 years prior to that, when it was really tough, you know, I almost kind of thrived in those periods because it was the challenge for me wanting to see it through. And I'm nothing if not stubborn. You can ask me, you know, my parents, anyone that knows me, I never give up. But maybe I should have done. I don't know. And it's things like that now that I'm questioning. But I do think, you know, what I went through for those 8 years that I ran it, for the, you know, however many years prior to that I was working in the team. Formula One does give you this incredible sense of resilience that you don't realize that you're building up until you probably leave. And, you know, whatever role you're in, you're building it up because it's a really, really tough sport.
And actually, although I'd love to just get straight in there and talk about all that through, I kind of want to rewind a little bit, because the first question I normally ask my guests, and I really want to ask you this one, is when and where did your racing life begin?
Well, it depends what you define as racing life, because obviously I was born into like the Williams family. So you could say my racing life, you know, started from, you know, the minute I was born, you know, and because I think we were so, as a family, so entwined in our team. You know, my dad never left his work at the office, always came home. You know, from a very early age, I was surrounded by people from Formula One. You know, if they came to the house or if I went to a race, not that we were ever taken to a race that often, we were kind of kept in the background, but you know, our kind of life was quite embroiled in that. So I think my exposure started from obviously from a very young age. And then as, you know, time progressed, I dipped in and out, you know, when I was 9 or 10, 13, 14, I wasn't really that interested, but I still did quite a lot of work at Williams. You know, when mum was bored of us, you know, in the week, or wanted a, not bored of us, but she wanted a bit of a break, she would, you know, tell my dad, you're taking the kids to the factory if that's where you're going today and you can have them. So, you know, I spent a lot of time at the factories that we had when we were little. I started working in the travel office when I was about 14, 15, and I loved it. And, you know, so my racing career, I suppose, has been my whole life. And I've been, I consider myself enormously lucky and privileged to have called that my childhood, I suppose.
What's your earliest memory of it? Have you got like a moment where you're aware it was motorsport around you?
Yeah, I think it was probably going to Zandvoort when we used to race back in Holland. God, and my dad, as I said, you know, dad did not take us to the races. We used to get to go to the Sunday of the British Grand Prix and that was it. And then for some bizarre reason, he allowed mum to take Jonathan, my older brother, and me to Zandvoort, I think for maybe 2 years in a row when we were racing there. And so being there, and but I don't remember being at the racetrack. I remember being at the beach, and I think Nigel Mansell coming along and taking us on the Dodgems and going and buying little mini clogs and stuff like that. But being kind of there, but not there.
That's brilliant. I mean, I know that was your life and that's how you grew up, but Nigel Mansell taking you to the Dodgems.
I know. We had quite a lot of that, you know. Jacques Lafitte, my younger brother's godfather. Most people won't know who Jacques Lafitte was, but he drove for us, you know, back in the 80s, I think it was. And, you know, my brother's christening, Jacques, he was a real funny man. He was a real prankster. You know, he brought a bird into the church and caused absolute chaos. And then, so which really upset my mother, as you can imagine, there's quite a formal christening ceremony in England. And then on the way home, Jacques decided that he wanted to drive my older brother and me home. So my parents, a bit reluctant, went, all right then. Jacques drove like a total nutter home. We were about 7 and 8, and Jacques had 1 foot out the window while driving, and then decided to overtake my parents with 1 foot out the window, one arm waving at them down a country road. Yeah, so this is the kind of world, that I, you know, stories that I get to tell now, and I'll get to tell my children and my grandchildren. And it is, as I keep saying, it's a real privilege.
It is, isn't it? It's just, I mean, it's what people are listening in for, actually. It's the stuff of dreams. It's what they dream of joining. So I'm glad it's every good as it should be. I always like to ask this question, but given your family background, it feels even more touching. Do you feel like you chose motorsport, or did it choose you?
Oh, good question. I think it probably chose me. I knew from a very early age that my parents didn't want any of us going into the family firm, so to speak. They made that really clear. This was not a typical kind of generational family business that would be taken over by one of us at all. It was made very obvious to us that we had to go off and, you know, do something else and make our own way in the world. And I was really fine with that. But, you know, I went to an all-girls Catholic boarding school in the 80s. And you weren't really educated in those days as a girl to really have a proper career. You know, we just weren't. You know, my ambition was to be a good wife and a good mother when I was in my teens. And really, that's all I wanted to do. I don't know why. I wasn't, unfortunately, lucky in that I had a vocation to medicine or to, you know, the legal world. A lot of my friends did. Unfortunately, I didn't. I wasn't smart enough. And so Formula One really, I think, chose me, because when I left, even at university, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just went and studied politics, not with a view to, you know, going having a political career, but because it sounded interesting. Anyway, when I left university, my dad put me in touch with the MD of Silverstone Circuit for some career advice. And just at the time, he had a vacancy in the press office and asked if I wanted to give it a go. So it was like, all right, I'll give it a try. And I loved it. I fell totally head over heels. And, you know, the rest is history, I suppose.
It makes sense to me, though, that you grew up kind of thinking being a mum and being a wife was, you know, something to aspire to. Your mum was formidable. You know, she would have shown you everything that she did. That was a big deal.
Yeah, my mum was really a big deal. Unfortunately, she passed away nearly 8 years ago now, but she was inspirational. And I think, you know, I think people still remember her in the paddock. She was a big figure, even though she wasn't there a whole lot. She is, well, just stuck to Silverstone pretty much her whole life. But, you know, when she was there, she had a big, big impact. And behind the scenes as well, she had an impact on Williams. And, you know, certainly from my perspective, I feel that if it weren't for mum, Williams may not be around, because she was the one that bankrolled it when my dad was, you know, running his race team out of a phone box because the bailiffs kept calling and, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, she was, you know, the woman behind the man, I think, and a real inspiration to me. And I know so many people.
Definitely. And I have to tell you personally, I love the fact that you have a logo for her and that it's on the cars. I love it.
Yeah, that was really special. We wanted to do that when she died and run it on the cars. And actually, it was very difficult when I left because I wanted to take it with me. You know, obviously, everyone knows that we run the Senna logo on the car, and that will remain forever. Unfortunately, you know, Dorilton, they're very comfortable with that. But it didn't feel right leaving. You know, it was almost like leaving mum there when the family aren't there. And that didn't feel right to me. So actually, it was Sophie that I asked to be in charge of removing the logos from the car. I didn't want to make a big deal. I just wanted her to have them removed for the next race. And then when I was leaving on that weekend, one of our mechanics asked me if we could keep it. He said, I'd heard that you want to, I'm going to get really upset now, but he said, I've heard you want to remove it. And I understand, but I know for me, and for so many people in the team, even though I didn't know your mum, and I know, you know, a lot of other people didn't know your mum, but it means an awful lot to us. And having that logo on our car is special for us, and we race for your family, and we'd like to keep it. And so I said, okay, you can keep it. And so she's still there. So she's still keeping an eye on our little racing team.
I love it. And I've just understood the significance of your parting gift. You were given a front wing.
Yeah, I was given a front wing. Yeah, actually, I hadn't put that together really. I was given a lovely, which I treasure. I was so spoilt that weekend. It was probably one of the best weekends of my entire life, even though it was one of the worst. The team blew me away. They really did.
I have to say, I watched, in preparation for our chat today, I watched the Formula One coverage of your last day. They did a video, which I didn't have time to watch during the season, as you can, I'm sure. I cried. I completely cried. You got me. Oh my gosh.
Sorry. Quite an emotional weekend. And I was pretty good. I held the tears back, at least publicly anyway. But, you know, privately, it would have been a different story. But until Sunday night when we had our party, and then it was like, oh, I think I shed a few tears when the front wing, they really got me. And all the TVs as well, all the TV crews were really trying to get me. It was like, I'm not doing it. I'm not crying on national television. You know, David Coulthard on Channel 4 and stuff. It's like, don't. Because I think if I'd have started, I never would have stopped.
That it gets too easy then. The tear ducts are open. I also love, can I just say, I love the fact that you left officially, you know, and efficiently, and then with the TVs following you, and then snuck back into the paddock later.
Yeah, that was quite weird because they were all following me, and I wasn't expecting that. I genuinely, when we made the announcement, I thought people would just go, okay, fine, you know, and I'd do a few interviews, a few TVs would be interested, and that would be it. But what happened was really quite extraordinary. And I suppose, you know, it's right, I suppose, with what Williams have contributed, but, you know, mostly what my dad has contributed to Formula One, not just to the team, but to the sport as a whole. I suppose it should have been done in that way, had that reaction. But yeah, leaving the paddock with a load of TV crews, knowing that I was coming back an hour or two later, I felt a bit disingenuous, I suppose.
I loved it. I thought it was absolutely the right thing to do.
just a good job that they didn't follow me coming out at 4 a.m. because that wasn't pretty.
I think one of the reasons I got so tearful, by the way, is because I feel up to a point I can completely relate with you. I mean, you know, press officer, yeah, with you, done it. Head of comms, yeah, get in there, kind of around that area. Marketing commercial, okay, fine, that, you know. But then joining the board and then becoming deputy team principal, you went so much further. You know, what was it like? What was the job like as well? Because not that many people actually know what a team principal has to do, really.
That's what I've been thinking about a lot recently, and I kind of pinched myself because 8 years does sound like a long time, and that's how long I was in the role for. But, you know, when you, and actually from on the board, I joined the board in 2011 or 2012, I can't remember now, but that's, you know, nearly 10 years. I can't even count. Anyway, when I now think back on it, it feels like it went in literally a heartbeat. But I do pinch myself that I was ever given that role. It's like, really? I was the press officer. I started as a junior press officer and managed to work my way up. But I always just got on with doing what anyone asked me to do. You know, I was asked to be the junior press officer. I got on and I did it and I loved it. If I was still there as a junior press officer, I would still love it and I would just be getting on with it. You know, obviously things didn't conspire that way, and I just ended up taking, you know, step up after step up. And I think one of the big reasons, obviously, that I was put in that DTP role was because of my name, and people liked the idea of, you know, a Williams continuing when Frank couldn't. I think the fact that I was a woman, I think some people liked the idea of, they thought that it would bring something different. It could bring some more power to the team, having a woman in that role. So, but, you know, being a TP, it's an extraordinary life. But I think any job in Formula One is, it does take so much out of you. And again, once you actually stop doing it, you don't realise what you have done, what you have achieved, what you've asked, even what you're asking yourself mentally to do, what you're asking, you know, of yourself physically. Because it's actually, you know, as much as you're, you know, it's a desk job at the end of the day, it's not like you're a mechanic or whatever. But it's physically exhausting running a Formula One team. Planes here and there, you're not just on planes going to the racetrack, you're going to meetings in between, and, you know, God knows where, what country you're going to next. You know, I've kept diaries, obviously, of all my time, and you can flick through them now, you know. And, you know, I always wrote down every meeting, every job that I had to do for the whole, you know, well, certainly for my DTP years, 8 years, but also for 5 years prior to that as well. And I flick through them. And you're like, my God, you know, I mean, the diary, every page, it's a big diary and it's full, you know, full of job after job after job. And you just think, Jesus, you know, that's a lot. You know, there's no downtime. There's no lunch break. There's, you know, hardly any time to go to the bathroom in the day. But so you're just doing so much. One minute you can be dealing with a driver issue that you've got who wants to be paid more money, or, you know, his seat's a problem, or you've got the guys downstairs saying, you know, they can't get this bolt from stores, and why can't we order that bolt? You know, I haven't got a credit card to order it from, or all these different things. And certainly in the last period where I was working at Williams, doing a lot of this next gen cultural transformation stuff, I was a strong believer that changing our culture at Williams was important to generating that success. For me, that was where I could input as much as the commercial and marketing side. I couldn't do anything on the technical side. So trying to build on, you know, that cultural piece was really important to me. So, you know, looking at diversity and making sure that we had strong representation of females within the team was something that I was working on. So, you know, the role of a TP is just so, from one minute to the next, you're having to, like, do, someone will put a bit of paper in front of you about this. And then, you know, you've got to then flick a switch and turn and think about, you know, something completely different, and have that ability to just mentally juggle everything all at the same time. But it's a wonderful, I loved it. You know, I miss it extraordinarily. So it was so brilliant. And I wish I could have continued doing it.
Normally being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
One thing I wanted to check, actually, because you literally, you did grow up in the paddock. I think you're one of the few people in the whole world that can say that. Did people change the way they behave as you became TP or DTP?
No, not really. And I really like that. And actually, somebody made a comment, a journalist made a comment when I became DTP and I started running the team. And, you know, obviously that was a big transition for me. You know, I had been a boss in marketing and commercial and comms and stuff. But I was suddenly a boss of everybody and people that I hadn't been a boss of previously. So that was quite difficult. But I did have, and what was really nice was that suddenly for me, people didn't treat me any differently. And I think that was because I'd grown up in the team. So many people knew me and had known me for either their whole time there or I'd known them for my whole time there. And I didn't run things in a kind of draconian way. Mine was a very collegiate, collaborative approach with everybody. No, and it was certainly an approach that my dad had instilled in me that nobody is more important than anyone else. Of course, we had hierarchies and you have to have that in an organization to make it function properly. But on a deeper level, a subconscious level, it was all of us in it together and we all just rolled our sleeves up together. But people said to me that I hadn't changed and that was meant a lot to me. Because maybe I should have changed, I don't know. But it was important to me that, and I read that as I hadn't just become tyrannical and power happy and or whatever. It was just, I was, again, just doing a different job. I was still the same person.
Talk to me about the D in your title, because I know it means a lot to you.
Obviously, people that run Formula One teams are team principals. And my dad has always carried that title and he was very reluctant to give it up, quite rightly so. He wasn't operating the business day to day. That was my job and had been since 2013 when I took over. But, you know, and in the beginning, I was kind of like, I really want the TP title. You know, I'm doing the job. I feel I should be called it. But my dad, I got frustrated for a period. There was a period where I was a bit like, oh, I just want it. And then actually it became really important to me that I didn't have it. Because my dad's team principal and I felt for, you know, as long as he was still alive, then he should always carry that title. He was our team principal. Yeah, he was still there. He was still at the factory. He was still our leader, our boss, who we all aspired to and why we were all there. You know, calling him anything else wouldn't have felt right. And so for me, being his deputy was something that I got quickly comfortable with. You know, in the beginning, I was incredibly proud and I was totally happy with it. As I said, I had a small middle bit where I was a bit like, I want it. And then it was like, no, I will never take the team principal title because that's my dad's. And I think if things had been different and, you know, maybe dad had passed away and if dad had passed away and I still was running the team, I don't think I would have ever taken the TP title. I think it would have gone with my dad.
I like that a lot. I think it just shows so much. Respect for the team.
That's so important, I think, from my perspective, that team. You know, I always felt like I was in a kind of caretaker role. And I know the critics will go, well, you didn't do a very good job of that, did you? But, you know, I very much felt that. These teams, they're not anybody's. Certainly Williams, it's my dad and Patrick's team. And, you know, Patrick made his decision to retire. Dad, operationally, wasn't involved anymore. And it was my job just to carry it through. I didn't feel like it was suddenly mine. I owned it. It was ours. You know, it was everybody in the teams. It was still my dad and Patrick's, but it was the teams, the 700 odd people in it. It was our job to keep carrying it for Frank and Patrick and to do our best.
I want to ask you about competition, because I always like to joke to say that, you know, even at press officer level, you're still looking left and right to see who sends out the press release and who's last.
Across the paddock, there is the most extraordinary level of competition. I've always said that, and I actually use it in a lot of my speeches that I made to, like, in presentations for, in pitches for money, was, you know, Formula One is the most competitive sport in the world. Even, you know, it's not just competing on the race track that we all get, you know, we all fight about, but it's, you know, down to the press officers who gets their press release out first, or who's written the best press release or the funniest press release or whatever. Formula One is just riddled with it, but that's what it should be.
How did that translate when you became, when you, you know, occupied your last role at the team? You know, do you feel competition when you're the team principal? I mean, obviously when you're sat on the pit wall, that's a very physical moment anyway, but just going that through your meetings, you know, you're like, oh, I'm going to be better than Toto.
Yeah, you do. And I remember there was a team principal kind of competition in readers had voted for their best favourite team principal. I think 14 or 15. I think now I'd probably be right down the pecking order. So thank God they haven't done it for a few years. But in the early days, I was voted as the reader's second favourite behind Toto. I was furious for days, absolutely livid that I hadn't won it. I don't know why I would have expected to win it. I was still pissed off, like I'm sure every other team principal was. Every team principal, you have to be, have such competitive fire in your stomach to run a Formula One team, because it takes so much out of you. If you don't have it, if you don't care that your driver is the best, that your car is the best, that your head of aero is the best, that your head of comms is the best in the paddock, then you've got no business running a Formula One team, because it's all about competition at every single level, you know. Even down to who says the best stuff in the team principal meetings. You know, you can see it. There's this big competition to who can say the cleverest thing. You know, it's all about competition. Who's chosen the best team kit? Ah, it's everything. Who's sat in the best seat in the plane home from the race? It's everywhere.
Who turned up at the correct time at the airport to make sure that you can bag the best seats?
Yeah, who leaves the paddock last? Which is, it was Gunther left before me tonight. You know, I'm in first. Yes. You know, it's pathetic. It's ridiculous.
It's so at the core of everything we do. Can you please tell me what the exact moment you realise that motorsport is not glamorous at all?
When you start working in it, I think it pretty quickly becomes pretty clear that, you know, it's not. But that's not to say it's not special, it's not wonderful. I think people think it's glamorous, but the hard work isn't. But what we do is a privilege. And I'm talking in the present tense, but everyone will understand that. You know, even like going to China, for example, which is one of the races, you know, it was always wet, it was always cold, the paddock's huge. It was, you know, our hotel was next to a pig abattoir, you know, things like that. It's not that, you know, it's not how people envisage Formula One. But even so, that is still incredible to know that you're going to Shanghai and you're going to the racetrack that is this incredible, you know, circuit built around lily pads and all the rest of it. So it might not be, some of it might not be glamorous, like when you're, you know, checking through the paddock, actually going through like mud, signing autographs. I used to do that quite a lot in a few races last year that were really, wet. And the fans are all lined up and you know, walking down and you want to sign everyone's stuff. And then you're there and then you've got to cross. Last year I had to cross some mud pool to get to the last five people who were behind this gate thing. And I didn't want to miss them out just because there was mud there. So I literally waded through this like cesspit of mud in my team kit. I was covered in the stuff. And they literally, when I got over to the other side, then they said no other team principal has been down here because they wouldn't cross through the mud. Again, I was like, yes, I came down here. But, you know, that stuff's not glamorous, is it? There's a lot of that. There's a lot of not glamorous stuff in Formula One, but equally there's awful, you know, a lot of good stuff in Formula One. And it's a whole lot better than a whole load of other jobs out there, isn't it?
Definitely. What's your proudest moment apart from crossing the mud to sign the five autographs? And did you get to celebrate it?
Probably that first third place that we took in 2014. I'd been DTP for a year and a half prior to that, inherited a team that had finished 9th, 8th, and 9th the 3 years prior to me taking over. And, you know, Williams was really in the doldrums, and it was really tough. And we did a lot of stuff to turn things around. And we had an incredible year in 2014, to the point where actually it was getting really tiresome to have to walk all the way down to the podium, because our team was, you know, still in P10 or P9 down the paddock. So you had to walk a mile, you know, or it would just get really boring having to reply to all the congratulatory text messages, you know, which is awful. And like, in the last few years, I'm now like, okay, this is my retribution, isn't it, for, you know, thinking those awful thoughts in 14 and 15. But that was my proudest. When we took P3, you know, we closed it out in Abu Dhabi at the last race. And I've never been more scared going to a race weekend. I can still picture myself sat in my seat on the plane coming into land and my stomach literally dropping, going, are we going to do this? Are we not? And this was the race where I voted in conjunction with a lot of other TPs for the double points. So it was absolutely possible that Ferrari could have taken us. And we got there, and all weekend, and I was probably white as a sheet. I just wanted to get to the race and to get it over with. It was the most painful race of my life watching. But Valtteri and Felipe took second and third behind, I don't know which Mercedes driver it was, and to see them on the podium and to know that we'd taken it, and coming out the back of the garage and, you know, just being with the boys afterwards, knowing that we'd done it, was incredible. And one of the nicest things anyone said to me before that race, when I was going around wishing everybody luck, you know, they were like, oh my God, Claire, you know, just calm down, it's fine. And then someone said, Claire, don't worry, we've got this. And do you know what they did? And the boys always had it, and they always had my back. And, you know, they're the best bunch of boys. And you know, they made me really proud. The team just made me really proud, always, regardless, even, you know, the good times or the bad times.
I want to be fair and ask you what your lowest point was, and obviously how you recovered it. But I want to caveat that, because you're really, really hard on yourself. And so I want your lowest point to not be something that you've done.
And my lowest point was, you know, not getting the car to testing. And that was a team effort, I think it'd be fair to say. But at the end of the day, I was the TP and, you know, DTP, and, you know, all of that shit falls on you when you're the boss. And, you know, you have to take the good with the bad. And so that was the worst time. It was the worst few weeks prior to it, and certainly the week prior to supposedly going testing was pretty horrendous. The day before, when we still thought we were going to make it, and then I got the phone call saying the car is not going on the transporter, Claire. I mean, literally was horrific. And then the aftermath, dealing with it. And then really that whole year was pretty bad. Monaco that year, I mean, we couldn't have made more mistakes in Monaco that year. That whole year was a real low point. But 19, as much as we again had a really shitty year, we cleared out the issues and we were able to start making progress and move forward. And if we hadn't have done that, we would have been in the same position as 18. So people always thought 19 was my worst year, but it was 18.
Yeah, you turned a corner by 19. You were like progressing and going back up, because it takes time.
Yeah, and actually, if you look at the times from 2020, you know, if you compare like where we were qualifying at the racetracks in 2020 versus 2019, you know, we were gaining, you know, 1.5, 2 seconds. That to gain that amount of time over the course of one season's development, I don't think anyone's ever done that. Yeah, that was extraordinary. But people don't see that. They still see you finishing 19th and 20th.
It's all relative, isn't it? But we know that George was hell-bent on scoring a point. You know, that was, he knew he could do it. It was his mission. And and he really felt like he had the car, he could do it. It was so, what a year.
Yeah.
I just wanted to end by asking something that obviously people are tuning in for, which is advice. You know, what advice to get into motorsport, which I'm sure you've given lots of times. But just to add as well, have you been given advice that served you well through your career as well?
I know the worst bit of advice that I've been given is I really should wear heels in the paddock when I'm working because I'm so short, which I love. Do you know, the best bit of advice I've been given has always been by my dad, and that's to work hard and you will get your just rewards. And I firmly believe it's true. There are so many lessons that I learned in my time in Formula One. You know, I could write a book on the number of lessons that I've learned, but you've just got to keep fighting and you never give up. And I think that same principle applies if you want to you know, if you want a career in motorsport, which I couldn't recommend highly enough. You know, we've talked about it, and I think you can hear the passion in both of our voices, right, when we talk about Formula One and what an incredible world it is to work in for so many reasons. The people are incredible. Everyone has everyone's backs, even across the paddock into teams. The work itself is so rewarding. Yeah, it's tough. Yeah, it's demanding, but it is so rewarding. At the end of the day, you're all making history. You know, you work in a sport, you're making history week in, week out, and you're part of something. And that's really special. So I would always advocate, you know, for anyone to take a serious look at Formula One, as, and, you know, particularly for girls that might be looking at it from the outside in. You might not see that many girls, but, you know, the camera really only focuses on the cars and the drivers. But there are a lot of women in Formula One. And I think that group of women are very close knit. They're quite tight. They support each other. But Formula One is a, you know, in general terms, I think it's very welcoming to women, and women shouldn't be put off by, you know, seeing so many men, because those men, certainly for me, I don't know, and I can't speak for other people, but I have never experienced any significant level of discrimination that, you know, that would put me off working. Yeah, there's banter and stuff like that, but none of it, you know, it's banter that you get anywhere, and, you know, you should get, because it, you know, it makes you stronger, and you give it back yourself. That's just what we all do, right? You know, the most level of criticism that I've had is from, you know, from the outside world that, you know, have never walked a day in my shoes, and, you know, you just ignore them. But, you know, just work hard, decide what you want to do, talk to people who work in the sport, build those connections, because it is tough to get into. You've got to really not give up, but not be annoying. And, you know, build your way up from, you know, the junior formula. That's often a really good entry point. But if you want to work in Formula One, there's no reason why you can't. There are no barriers. You're good at what you do. You have every right to work in that sport.
Thank you, Claire. Just to wrap up, I'd like to ask you, what are you looking forward to?
Looking forward to lockdown restrictions lifting so I can get on an aeroplane. And I never I would say that. I need to travel. I think, again, once you've been traveling for so many years of your life, to not do it is quite freaky. And again, not being in a hotel, you become so institutionalized by airplanes and hotels that when you can't do it, you're like, I keep saying to my husband, I just need to stay for a night in a hotel. I've got withdrawal. It's like a withdrawal symptom or something. So I'm looking forward to lockdown, like everybody is, restricting when it's safe to, for it to be so, and to do a bit of traveling. I want to go away and, you know, have a bit of time on the beach.
It sounds perfect. Thank you so much for your time, Claire. It's been absolutely amazing chatting to you.
No, it's been lovely. Thank you for having me.
That was the amazing Claire Williams. And I have to thank her once again for giving up her precious time to share her stories on this podcast. It was a privilege to chat to her so openly. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe via your favourite podcast platform, tell your friends, post about it on social media. It all means so much, and I read every message and every mention. You can also get in touch directly if you'd like via my Instagram account, which is Pandea, P-A-N-D-E-A. And there's now a link in the show notes via which you can support the podcast directly, should you wish to. It takes an awful lot of coffee to make this show, as you can imagine. Can't believe I'm saying this, but thank you very much for listening. We're back. Speak to you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.